All right. Well, it's my great pleasure to introduce our second speaker for the evening, Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky. I hadn't gotten to my introduction yet. And I'm reminded of the story of the first time that Ravi Shankar played at Carnegie Hall. And he came out onto the stage and he was strumming away, and then he stopped and the crowd burst into applause. And then he said, "Well, if you like the tuning that much, you'll love the music." Professor Chomsky is Institute Professor Emeritus at MIT, and I'm sure many of you know that he completely reshaped the field of linguistics. His work in linguistics also had profound impact on both philosophy and psychology. But that's not why we're here to hear him tonight. Since the 1960s, Professor Chomsky has been a major voice on the left, not only in the United States, but globally. And it always makes me very happy when I visit India and go to a bookshop and I see just about all of his books for sale in the major bookstores in big urban areas in India. Since the 60s, Chomsky has been a committed and courageous critic of U.S. foreign policy, as well as the U.S. empire. And through his writings, his lectures, and his activism, he's educated and inspired many here in the United States and around the world. I want to tell you the story of one individual whose life was turned upside down by Noam Chomsky. About 5 years ago, a young ex-Marine named Michael Hoffman spoke here in Watertown, about 500 yards from where we are meeting tonight, just down the street, down Mount Auburn Street. When stationed in Texas, Michael Hoffman visited a bookstore near his base and there picked up a copy of Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance, which Chomsky published in 2003. Hoffman told us that night that he read the whole book standing up in the bookstore. And he literally couldn't believe it. This was not the America that he knew. He bought Hegemony or Survival, and he said that he read it 3 more times. With these words of Noam Chomsky, Hoffman began a journey that led to the founding of Iraq Veterans Against the War, which Hoffman was one of the co-founders of. Now, there are countless others whose worldviews have been transformed by the words of Chomsky and who have then been sparked into action. And there are many millions whose commitment to fight has received badly needed sustenance from Chomsky, from his lectures, and from his books. I'm very pleased that he was able to fit us into his schedule tonight, also very much at the last minute, but for a very important event. So please join me in welcoming him tonight.
Well, let me begin with two caveats, pitfalls that I think we should be careful to avoid. It's very important to have this meeting about Gaza, one of the most disgraceful situations in the world. But we should remember that it's only in U.S. and Israeli policy that Gaza is separated from the West Bank. They're a unity. One unit, what's left of Palestine, 22% of the original mandate. Now, it's very important for the U.S. and Israel to separate the two and isolate them. For one thing, that means if there ever is some kind of a political settlement, the West Bank will be deprived of any access to the outside world. It'll be imprisoned. It won't have a seaport. It'll essentially be contained by two enemies. So there is a strategic reason for the long-standing and intense effort to distinguish Gaza and the West Bank, to keep them apart, to ban transport, and also kind of ideologically to make them seem as if they're two different places. They aren't, outside of U.S.-Israeli ideology, and we should be careful not to to resist that, I think. Another division that I think it's important to resist is between U.S. and Israel. Now, we constantly talk, rightly, about Israeli crimes, but that's highly misleading because they are U.S.-Israeli crimes. There's nothing that Israel does that goes beyond what the United States authorizes and, in fact, directly supports with economic, diplomatic, military, and also ideological support, that is, by framing issues. So these are U.S.-Israeli crimes. If we talk about Israel, we should remember we're talking about ourselves. It's not like talking about crimes of China. These are very important to keep in mind. Now, turning to Gaza and the West Bank, the separation of Gaza and the West Bank is part of a much more general policy, a policy of fragmentation of the residue of Palestine, so that it cannot hope to emerge as a viable entity. Separating Gaza from the West Bank is one part of it. Gaza, as Nancy pointed out, has been converted into a prison. The screws are being steadily tightened so that it becomes a maximum security prison, something like Guantanamo. It's kind of a little odd on the side that there's been so much horror in the United States about Guantanamo. It's not very different from the maximum security prisons that the United States runs, and we're unique in the world, in the Western world, in having an incarceration system of this kind. So it's not just becoming a prison, it's becoming something like a maximum security prison, which is basically a torture chamber. It's under constant siege, a very harsh and brutal siege. A siege is an act of war. Of all countries in the world, Israel surely is unusual in recognizing that. It twice launched a war, 56 and 67, on the grounds that its access to the outside world was very partially restricted. That was considered a crime, and a total siege is, of course, a much greater crime. So it's a major war crime that we're carrying out. Supplies, as you just heard, are restricted so that you have bare survival. There's constant and systematic attacks on all the borders, including the coastline, to drive the population inland. On the borders, that takes away the limited arable land. On the sea, what it has done is drive the fishing fleet to a couple of kilometers from the shore, where fishing is impossible because of the conditions that Nancy described. After the destruction of the sewage systems, the power systems, the other infrastructure, fish can't survive and people can't survive near the sea, so that destroys the fishing industry, and it contains Gaza even more narrowly. Again, part of the policy of imprisonment. It sounds like sadism, and it is, but it's kind of rational sadism. It's achieving a well-understood and carefully planned the end of U.S. and Israeli policy. There are also regular atrocities, special atrocities, just to keep showing who's boss. So end of September, Israeli troops entered northern Gaza and kidnapped five children, brought them over to Israel. They disappeared into the Israeli prison system. Nobody knows too much about it. It includes secret prisons, which occasionally surface. It's estimated that roughly 1,000 people are there, often for years, without any charge at all, just hidden away somewhere. So these kids probably joined that. All of this happens with total impunity. It happens regularly. With complete impunity, that's part of our ideological contribution to ensuring the crushing of Palestinians. It's been going on for decades, in fact, in Lebanon and in the high seas. Israel has been hijacking boats on the way from Cyprus to Lebanon, capturing or sometimes killing passengers, taking them to Israel, keeping them as in prisons, sometimes for decades, sometimes as hostages for eventual release, no charges. Often we only barely know where they are by occasional surfacing of stories about secret prisons which aren't published in the United States, though they are in Europe and in Israel. And this is again done with complete impunity because we permit it. We say we're not going to talk about it, so therefore impunity. This is worth remembering when you read about the what's considered now one of the primary barriers to negotiations, the fate of an Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, who was captured at the border on June 25th, 2006. Well, capture of a soldier of an attacking army is some sort of a crime, I suppose. It doesn't rank very high among crimes. And against the background of constant hijacking of boats, kidnapping of civilians, killing of civilians on the high seas in Lebanon, it doesn't rank very high. And the situation is made even more dramatic by the fact that one day before Corporal Shalit was captured on the border, Israeli troops entered Gaza City, kidnapped two civilians, a doctor and his brother, spirited them across the border, and they too disappeared into the U.S.-backed Israeli secret prison system. And nobody's talking about negotiations to get them out. They're Arabs, so they have no human existence. So we don't talk about them. And in fact, it was barely reported here because it's insignificant. But that's worth... Shalit ought to be returned in a prisoner exchange. But that's a toothpick on a mountain, but the one that we talk about. And other crimes just go on regularly. Like a few days ago, you may have read that Israel banned the shipment of cooking gas into Gaza. Just an act of gratuitous cruelty. It means that it's used for almost everything. So that's gone. The water system is under very severe attack. The International Committee of the Red Cross and the UN Environmental Protection Agency, which work there, estimate that by now only maybe 5 to 10% of the water, the very limited water in the strip, is usable. Israel has constantly attacked the water system. The last invasion, U.S.-backed Israeli invasion a year ago, destroyed around 30 kilometers of pipes, other equipment. Nothing is allowed back in to repair them. So by now, as Nancy said, children are dying of diseases from poisoned water. And that's going to continue. The Red Cross estimates that if this continues, it would, in the best of circumstances, unless something's done about it, it may take centuries before this region becomes viable, you know, before it's possible for life to exist there. Well, this is more rational savagery. A couple of months ago, I was out in California giving a fundraising talk for the Middle East Children's Alliance. It's a marvelous organization that's been working in Gaza and other places for years. Barbara Lubin, its director, had just come back from Gaza, a very heroic woman. She talked, as Nancy did, about what they found. One of the things they did, the delegation, was to go around to schools and just ask children, if you had one request, what could it be? Would it be? And then they thought they might direct their funding to that. And overwhelmingly, what children said in the schools is that they would like is a drink of water in the morning. Well, that's Gaza. And they did manage to find mechanics in the region, in the strip, who were able to construct small water purification devices, and they're trying now to fund enough water purification made with local materials so that maybe children can have a drink of water in the morning, their fondest wish. Well, that's what we're doing. We're doing, and we should remember that. There's a purpose. The purpose was explained right at the beginning of the occupation by Moshe Dayan, who was the Minister of Defense and in charge of the occupied territories. In late 1967, he informed his colleagues that we should tell the Palestinians and the territories that we have nothing to offer them. They will live like dogs, and those who will leave, and we'll see where this ends up. And that's the policy. It's quite rational. Live like dogs, and we'll see what happens. So yes, sadism, but rational sadism. And things are not dramatically different in the West Bank, somewhat, but not much. First of all, everything turning to the West Bank, just about everything that's going on there is in violation of international law, gross violation. There's a lot of talk here about expansion of the settlements. That's completely diversionary. It has almost nothing to do with the issues. I mean, even if there was no further expansion of the settlements, they already destroy the possibilities of a viable Palestinian existence. Every one of them is illegal and known to be. There isn't any controversy about it. In late 1967, Israel was informed by its highest legal authorities, the main one, Theodor Meron, a very respected international lawyer, judge in the criminal courts, the international criminal international tribunals, and he informed the government of what, in fact, is transparent, that transferring population to occupied territories is in gross violation of the Geneva Conventions. It's the foundations of international humanitarian law. The Attorney General affirmed his conclusion a couple of years ago. As you know, it was reaffirmed by the International Court of Justice. Moshe Dayan, who was in charge, recognized that in late 1967. He said, yes, it's true. Everything we're doing is in violation of international law, but that's often done, so we'll dismiss it. And he's right. As long as the Godfather says it's fine, you can dismiss it. So yes, we'll go on carrying out criminal acts, and we'll debate some minor crime, you know, like maybe expanding. We'll debate expanding settlements to allow natural growth. That'll divert attention from the real issue, and we'll be able to believe that our government is somehow acting humanely and as a in an effort to achieve peace. That expansion of the settlements, which is the big issue that we're supposed to be excited about, even a 10-month alleged suspension, which Hillary Clinton praised as unprecedented generosity, all of that, even that little toothpick is a fraud. When Obama announced that he wanted a termination of expansion of the settlements, he was just quoting George W. Bush. That's in the, who had said exactly the same thing, and in fact it's in the so-called roadmap, the officially agreed framework for policy. When that's ever mentioned, it's rarely pointed out that Israel did accept the roadmap formally, but immediately added 14 reservations, which completely eviscerated it. So it rejected the roadmap with U.S. Acquiescence. So therefore, as Dayan said, well, yes, fine, we'll just dismiss it. But that's in the roadmap. Obama repeated it just as Bush did, but he repeated it with the usual wink. When asked, his spokesperson said that the U.S. opposition to the expansion was purely symbolic. He would not go even as far as Bush number one, who imposed very mild sanctions for expansion of settlements. But Obama made clear, no, we're not going to do that. These are just symbolic statements. So this minor diversionary operation can continue with effective U.S. support. It's all illegal. We permit it, so therefore it's fine. It's authorized. And it expands the principle of fragmentation, which is the core of U.S.-Israeli strategic policy. So separate Gaza from the West Bank. In the West Bank itself, the program is for Israel to take whatever's valuable and break up the rest into unviable cantons. What's valuable is, first of all, the water resources. It's a pretty arid region, but there is an aquifer, there's water, and it runs on the West Bank, on the Palestinian side of the international border. So Israel has to annex that. And that's also some of the most arable land. And it's also the nice suburbs. It's the pleasant suburbs of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, kind of like Lexington, where I live, relative to Boston. Nice place to live. So that all happens to be in the West Bank, so we have to accept, annex that. And there's a wall, as you know, snaking through the West Bank. It should properly be called the annexation wall, because the plan is to annex everything that's inside it, incorporate it within Israel, and that's with a polite smile from the Godfather, so therefore that's okay. It's interesting, in the commemorations of November 9th, fall of the Berlin Wall, Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, made an impassioned speech about how we have to bring down all the walls that divide us, but not the one cutting through the West Bank, which is about twice as high as the Berlin Wall and far longer, and simply stealing land from defenseless people, thanks to the leader of the free world and us, because we're allowing it. So take over everything that's valuable kind of near the border. Take over the Jordan Valley on the other side. That's about a third of the West Bank. And the Palestinians are being kept out of it by one means or another, or driven out. It's being settled. That imprisons what's left. And what's left is divided by carefully planned settlement salients, which cut through to break it up into parts. So there's one going east of what's called Jerusalem, greatly expanded region. Greater Jerusalem expands almost all the way to Jericho. There's another, essentially bisects the West Bank. There's another to the north, including the town of Ariel. Another one north of that goes to Kedumim. And so it essentially breaks the region up. There's technically contiguity way over through the desert to the east, but it's essentially unviable. And what remains is broken up by hundreds of checkpoints, which are there primarily for harassment. They're moved, so you never know exactly where they're going to be. But it means, for example, that if you want to visit your cousin 2 miles away, you know, it may take you 5 hours to get there if you ever manage. And an ambulance may take, say, 2 hours to get from one spot to a hospital a couple of miles away, because it has to go through checkpoints, and patient has to be carried over, you know, a big barrier, put in another one on the other side, and so on. These are essentially techniques of harassment. They have no security purpose, even a remote one, but they are perfectly rational to ensure that the population will live like dogs, and if they want to leave, that's fine, they'll leave. That's aside from the actions in what's called Jerusalem, vastly expanded region around what used to be Jerusalem. There, the actions are doubly illegal. They're not only in violation of international law, they're also in violation of explicit Security Council resolutions, barring any modification of the status of Jerusalem. Actually, the U.S. Signed those, or joined in those resolutions back in the late 60s and for several years afterwards. So they're doubly illegal, and continue. I mean, that's what you read every day in the papers about new buildings, taking over of Palestinian homes. There's now, it was just reported that in the last year, Israel radically accelerated its withdrawal of residence status for inhabitants of Jerusalem, for whom the courts decided that the center of their life was somewhere else. In that case, you can have your residence removed if you're a Palestinian. There's no case on record that I know of an Israeli who had citizenship reduced because the center of their life is in Los Angeles or New York, for example. So it's just another racist law designed to rid the region of the sort of rabble, that vermin that are in the way. We're kind of familiar with that in American history. It resonates. That's why we're here, basically, because, yeah, that's what we did in the conquest of the national territory, except that the U.S. was much more violent, exterminated the indigenous population. But it's a familiar pattern. I suspect it's part of the reason for the residual sympathy for Israel's activities. It strikes a kind of a chord in our own national history, maybe one we don't like to look at much. Expropriation continues steadily. By now, rough estimates, about a third of the West Bank has been expropriated, converted into state land. Yossi Sarid mentioned recently that this means that Israel can continue settlement for 100 years without expropriating anything any further. That's what continues. Senator Kerry has an interesting stand on this. He's very close to Obama. He's become more or less his foreign policy kind of emissary. He gave the most important speech in the Obama administration's policies. It was a speech to the Brookings Institution a couple of months ago. Obama took the standard position. Party line is the United States is an honest broker, trying desperately to bring peace to these two difficult antagonists. He repeated that. That's normal. But then he added that for a long time, Israel has been seeking a legitimate partner for peace, and it's never had one. So it's kind of, devastated. Who can we negotiate with? But Kerry said that now, finally, Israel may have a legitimate partner for peace. But what was interesting is he gave his evidence. His evidence was that during the U.S.-Israeli attack on Gaza, which he didn't, of course, describe it that way, during the U.S.-Israeli attack on Gaza, there were no protests on the West Bank. It was quiet. Of course, that's the other half of Palestine, but they didn't do anything about it. And he explained why. He said the reason is that the U.S. has established an army, a mercenary army, headed by U.S. General Dayton, trained with the assistance of Jordan and Israel, and the army is able to suppress any sign of resistance to what the U.S. and Israel are doing in Gaza. So things are really looking up. There's a possibility that there might be a legitimate partner, controlled by a paramilitary force that is under our command. I should mention that the Dayton Army is under State Department control, meaning at least some kinds of weak restrictions on human rights and other conditionalities. But people in the West who know the West Bank say that there's a much more savage force, which is under CIA control, General Intelligence, and that's subject to nothing. That's standard all over the world. So we have military forces that can keep the population quiet. There's a collaborationist elite. Living in Ramallah, it's kind of like Tel Aviv, Paris, and New York. A lot of money flowing in from the European Union. Cultural life, people live pretty well. A few miles away in the villages, life's entirely different. But this is the model, the perfect model of a neo-colonial society. That's what the U.S. is, and the U.S. has plenty of experience with this. This is the model that was crafted in the Philippines a century ago after the U.S. conquered the Philippines, to uplift them and Christianize them and so on, all the most noble motives, killing a couple hundred thousand. There was a problem what you do with them. So a new model of control was developed, which was a real break from the European imperial pattern, and it's pretty much what I described. There's a military force, the Philippine Constabulary, but it has to have a collaborationist elite. The nationalist movement was broken up by various devices, subversion, spreading of rumors, all sorts of other things. And the population was put under very tight surveillance and control, using the highest technology of the day. This is a century ago, so that meant telephone, radio, and so on. And they had extremely tight surveillance of the population, knew where everybody was, and so on. Those techniques were later developed, applied in other U.S. domains, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, and so on. And they blew back to the United States very quickly. In fact, Woodrow Wilson applied them in the United States in his during the First World War, and we're familiar with them today, and even more so elsewhere, like Britain. In the West Bank, which is, as Nancy pointed out, an experimental region, biometric controls are extremely sophisticated. So there's identification of every person by any kind of measure you can think of, all on their identity cards. Pretty soon they'll be in chips put into their brains or something. There's talk of extending these measures to Israel. And there it's arousing a lot of protest, but in the West Bank, no protest. We just do that. So this is a familiar technique, and it works. The Philippines are still under that control. It's 100 years. And that's one of the reasons why the Philippines, the one American colony in East Asia, Southeast Asia, hasn't joined the economic, exciting economic developments of the past 20 years. It's not one of the East Asian tigers. So that's a model which can be followed and which might work if we allow it. There are, of course, pretexts for all of this. Whatever a state does, there's a pretext, security. Whatever you do, it's in self-defense, kind of by definition. And as usual, in this case, the pretext doesn't stand up to a moment's scrutiny. So take, say, the annexation wall. I mean, if the reason that's offered is defense, security. I mean, if the concern were security, we know exactly what would be done. The wall would be built on the international border. It could be made impregnable, patrolled on both sides, a mile high, totally secure, and that would give security. But, of course, if the purpose is what it actually is, namely to steal land and resources, then it can't be built on the international border, where it might furthermore inconvenience Israelis instead of just inconveniencing and, in fact, stealing from Palestinians. And the same is true of the attack on Gaza. It's almost universally accepted here and in the West generally that Israel had a right of self-defense and therefore was justified in attacking Gaza, even though the attack was maybe disproportionate. That's accepted, for example, by the Goldstone Report. The Goldstone Report is a very valuable account of the atrocities that were carried out in the course of the war, but they're regarded as disproportionate actions in a legitimate war of self-defense. Well, if you think about it for a minute, there is indeed a right of self-defense. Sure, everyone agrees to that. But there is no right of self-defense by force. That has to be argued. And there's extensive international law and just common sense on this. You do not have the right to use force in self-defense unless you have exhausted peaceful means. Well, in this case, there definitely were peaceful means. The U.S. and Israel knew it, and they chose not to even attempt them because they wanted a war. They wanted to attack. The peaceful means were obvious. They're not, again, not controversial. There had been a ceasefire initiated the preceding June 2008. Israel concedes officially that during the ceasefire there was not a single Hamas rocket fired. Sderot was quiet. The ceasefire was broken on November 4th when, using the cover of the U.S. election, Israel invaded the Gaza Strip, killed half a dozen Hamas activists, and then rockets started firing. In the following month, Hamas offered repeatedly to reinstate the ceasefire. Israel acknowledged it. Cabinet discussed it, decided not to accept it. Okay, no right of use of force in self-defense. It evaporates. That's quite apart from the conditions of international law, which I won't even go into, which are pretty explicit on this, all violated. So the attack itself was a criminal act. The U.S. and Israel are guilty of outright aggression. And if they fired one bullet, it was a crime. And if they carried out the atrocities that they did, it was a crime. And if you look case by case, there's virtually no justification for the claim of security. And in fact, I won't go into the history here, but it goes back at the very least until February 1971. This has kind of been washed out of history because it doesn't look nice for us. But in February 1971, President Sadat of Egypt offered Israel a full peace treaty, nothing for the Palestinians, just mentioned as refugees, on condition that Israel withdraw from the occupied territories. Now, all that he cared about was withdrawal from Egyptian territory. So, in effect, it was an offer of a full peace treaty with all the appropriate guarantees and so on, in return for withdrawal from conquered Egyptian territory. 1 year later, Jordan made the same offer with regard to the West Bank. Full peace treaty if Israel withdraws from the West Bank. Well, at that point, the security problem was over, if Israel wanted it to be over. If they'd accepted those peace treaties, the major Arab state, Egypt, would be out of the conflict, and Jordan, minor Arab state on its other border, would be out of the conflict. Okay, end of security problems. There was no Palestinian security problems to speak of at the time, and such as there were, could easily have been controlled. But Israel made a decision, fateful decision, to choose expansion over security. At that time, expansion into northeast Sinai, where they were planning to build a huge city, Yamit, and a lot of settlements. The real question is, what's the godfather going to say? Well, there was debate in Washington. There was an internal controversy. Henry Kissinger won out. His position, as he says, was what he called stalemate. We should have no negotiations, just force. And so Israel was able to reject the peace offer. I won't go into the consequences, but it meant an awful war, a lot of suffering, and constant security problems. And if you look from then through now, it's pretty much the same. I mean, Israel could have security right now. The Arab League has long endorsed the international consensus on a two-state settlement. In fact, they initiated it. The major Arab states in January 1976, when they introduced a resolution at the Security Council calling for a full peace treaty on the international border. It was vetoed by the United States, and a U.S. veto is a double veto. It doesn't happen, and it's out of history, so we don't talk about that. And so it continues. The Arab states have reiterated in more developed form a peace agreement, full peace agreement. The Organization of Islamic States, which includes Iran, has accepted it. Hamas has accepted it. In fact, anybody relevant has accepted it, with the exception of the United States and Israel. So yes, there are real security problems, but not justifiable ones. Among all the reports, hope this is a little better. Among all the reports, there were a number of reports that came out about Gaza, the Goldstone reports, an extensive one, Amnesty International published several, Human Rights Watch. They are very revealing. In my opinion, the most revealing of all of them at least the most important for us, is an Amnesty International report, which really broke new ground for human rights reports. It went through the weaponry that had been used in the assault against Gaza. A lot of high-tech, destructive, murderous weaponry. It traced it to its source, which is mostly back to us, and it called for an arms embargo. Amnesty International called for an arms embargo on both sides, which means essentially on Israel. That's talking to us. That's saying we ought to join in an arms embargo and stop sending arms in violation of international law and indeed in violation of U.S. law. We should stop violating U.S. law and sending arms to a country that's using them for aggression and violence and destruction. Well, you know, that's a policy that Americans ought to follow. Let's follow U.S. law. Let's try that for a change. And stop sending arms to Israel. Well, that's, I think, adhering to the Amnesty International plea would be make a lot of sense. There have been occasional reports from Human Rights Watch and others saying, you know, some arms shouldn't be sent to a country that's used, it's carrying out regular torture and so on. But this is the first call that I know of by a human rights group for a total arms embargo to an aggressive and violent state. And the call is directed to us. We're the ones providing the overwhelming bulk of the arms and are continuing to do it. And I think we should listen to that call. That also suggests something about tactics. If we want to act in ways which are going to change policy, and not just make us feel good, but change policy, the tactics should be directed to Washington. Unless Washington changes its position, there isn't going to be any peaceful settlement. And there are good historical analogies that we can use to kind of sharpen up our thinking about this. It's pretty common to make analogies between Israel and South Africa. Most of those analogies are pretty dubious. And there's some similarities, but enormous differences. One fundamental difference is that the white nationalists in South Africa needed the black population. That was the source of their labor and sustenance. So they didn't want them to live like dogs and flee the country. They wanted them to stay there and be a subordinate population. That's quite different in the case of Israel. They don't want the Palestinians. They want them out, away somewhere, like the U.S. attitude toward the indigenous population here, just either die or disappear. And that's a serious disanalogy. But there are some, even though the analogies are weak, we can learn something from the history. And the history is worth thinking about. By the early 1960s, South Africa was becoming a pariah state. There were talk of sanctions and boycotts, hadn't been implemented yet. There were negative votes in the United Nations. There were sharp attacks. And the South Africans were aware of it. They did pretty much the kind of thing that Israel's doing today. No good? Their action... why don't I just hold it? Okay. Is this going to work? I've been a technophobe all my life, and the more experience I have, the more I hate it. Okay. South Africa was reacting at the time very much the way Israel is doing now. The whole world hates us. They're just racist. They don't understand how wonderful we are. We have to have better information and educational campaigns to explain to them how what we're doing is exactly right and to the benefit of the black population and so on. They were doing all those things, but they knew pretty well they're not going to work, just as Israel ought to understand that the comparable efforts are not going to work. They're going to continue being turning into a pariah state. But the South African foreign minister, about 50 years ago, spoke to to the U.S. ambassador, and he said something quite perceptive and relevant. He told the U.S. ambassador that, yes, overwhelmingly they're voting against us in the United Nations and so on, but in the United Nations there's only one vote, yours. And as long as you're backing us, it doesn't matter what the rest of the world says. That's a pretty accurate perception. That's what it means to have overwhelming global dominance of a kind that's never existed in history. And he was right. And if you look at the history of what followed, it demonstrated it. Through the 60s and the 70s, South Africa became more and more a pariah nation. The United States and Britain kept supporting it. By 1980 or so, boycott sanctions and so on were beginning. U.S. corporations were beginning to refuse to invest. Congress began passing legislation. But the U.S. continued to violate it. the Reagan administration violated congressional legislation and overwhelming global opinion to continue supporting South African apartheid. And that was one of the most violent and brutal periods. In the 1980s, with U.S. support, South Africa was able to kill an estimated 1.5 million people and cause about $60 billion of damage just in the neighboring countries, putting aside what it was doing inside South Africa, with constant U.S. support. Went on through the 80s. In 1988, at that time, almost, you couldn't find anybody defending apartheid, mayors, corporations, Congress, whatever. In 1988, the U.S. formally identified the African National Congress, Mandela's ANC, as one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. That was 1988. You'll be pleased to know, if you don't already, that Mandela was taken off the terrorist list a couple of months ago, so we no longer have to be terrified of him. Around 1989, for reasons which are not entirely known, we don't have internal documents for that period, a U.S. policy shifted, and it moved towards ending apartheid and instituting a regime which sort of maintains the social and economic structure of the apartheid regime, but without total exclusion of blacks. So if you go to, say, Cape Town and Johannesburg, you can see black faces in the limousines, even though for another signs of improvement, it was a major achievement getting rid of apartheid. But the fundamental structure was maintained. However, apartheid was ended. Mandela was let out of prison. He was given a couple of years of instruction and democracy and freedom and so on, and then he was allowed to appear. And the U.S., the Godfather, changed its position, and it ended. If you go back to 1988, it looked like one of the worst periods in South African history. People were desperate, giving up. And that's happened elsewhere. So the South African minister was correct. And it's happened in other cases, too. I have no time to go through them. But there are other cases where just a slight shift in U.S. policy terminated violent, murderous aggression, in fact, near genocidal aggression. And it could happen in this case, too. But something's going to have to press it, and that's going to have to come from inside. It's not going to come from the rest of the world. And I think these are lessons that we ought to keep in mind when we think about, first of all, our own responsibilities and also the kinds of tactical moves that would be appropriate. Thanks.